Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And now your wings go out over cropped up skies, and I saw you there in the wind and the sky, and I shook my head at your cropped up eyes, and I'll never tell a lie. Taught me how, like a rail yard man, until we meet. And now your wings go out over Arkansas, and I saw you there in the wind and the sky, and I shook my head at your crop dust eyes, and I'll never tell a lie.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Do y'all like Bonnie? Bonnie Montgomery is a classically trained opera composer by day and a honky-tonk queen by night. She co-wrote the opera Billy Blythe about the childhood of Bill Clinton and opened for Gossip on their 2012 U.S. and European tours. She will be touring throughout the U.S. in support of her new EP, Joy, on the Fast Weapons record label this summer. She has CDs for sale tonight after the show, and more can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared this stage with late blues legend Frank Frost, who was featured in the movie Crossroads. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we have a featured artist. Tonight's featured artist is Little Rock multimedia artist Carla McGoldrick with her pinup, the one over here, which is entitled Safe Return, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Carla at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight is our 7th annual Mother's Show, and our writers show us in various ways the wisdom of motherhood. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, DJ Duckworth takes on the role of mother by answering some very challenging questions. And we'll end the night with Heath Carpenter as he discovers that moms all over the world really do know best. But let's start the night with Dina Nall, an insect attack, and her mother's quick thinking that saved more than the day in Benji and the Scamp.
The streets of Big Spring, Texas were filled with lunch hour traffic. My mom and I had spent that Saturday morning at the BMX track watching my older brother race his bike, and now we were finishing up some errands downtown in our 1971 Plymouth Scamp. The Scamp was our family's most prized possession. I didn't think of it as a car. To me, it was more of an older sibling. The Scamp was metallic gold with a black hardtop. It featured a crackly AM radio and manual door locks that gave a satisfying thunk when you pushed them down. Something about the way the car's smell revealed car sickness episodes of family vacations past made this car uniquely ours. By the time I was in second grade, the Scamp had seen better days. Not the least of its many quirks was the chain of events set in motion by the driver making a hard left turn. The glove compartment would release and the passenger door would swing wide open. The door ajar while the car was in motion was especially dangerous in the late 70s when none of us wore seatbelts. So my dad solved the problem by tying the door closed with a piece of bright yellow rope. The door still swung open an inch or two, but not enough for any of us to fall out. As Mom and I made our way through Big Spring's noon traffic, she suddenly slammed on the brakes, nearly throwing my unseat-belted body into the dashboard. "Something's biting me," she yelled, slapping frantically at her clothes. This was West Texas, and the region has its share of terrifying insects. One of them had apparently made its way into Mom's clothing while we were at the racetrack, and had saved its attack for now. Mom hit the gas and swung into a hard left turn, causing the glove compartment door to pop open into my lap and the passenger door to swing out a couple of inches before the bright yellow rope caught it. During the few seconds the door was open, my school library book, which had been on the floor, slid through the 2-inch opening onto the street. This was not good. In my world, losing a library book was pretty much the worst thing a kid could do. And this was a book about Benji, the movie dog that I adored. I really needed to get my book back, but Mom was trying to navigate traffic while being attacked by an unidentified carnivorous insect, so I kept quiet. She pulled into the city library parking lot and ran inside to the restroom to shake her clothes out, but the culprit had vanished. On the way home, I remained silent about the tragedy of my lost library book. Mom had just survived a harrowing attack. She didn't need to be bothered with my problems. But that book had been entrusted to me by the angelic Mrs. Beecham, librarian of Kentwood Elementary School. I tried not to imagine it being ground to a papery pulp beneath the tires of Big Spring's hectic lunch hour traffic. We got home and I sulked around the house, wondering what I could possibly say to sweet Mrs. Beecham about my library book when I returned to school on Monday. I hadn't just lost the book. The Scamp had launched it out into an intersection to face certain destruction. Late that afternoon, my dad came home from work, unaware of the incident earlier in the day. He slapped something down on the kitchen table. "Look what I found in the street downtown today," he said. It was my Benji book. My dad had no idea that it was mine or that I had lost it, so both parents were stunned when I yelled, "My book!" It was a little dirty, but it had survived the ordeal. For years, we would wonder what the chances were of my dad stumbling across a library book that happened to be mine in a busy downtown street, and what kind of insect had attacked my mom. Not surprisingly, we never learned the answers to these questions. However, while some things will forever remain a mystery, what was clear then, and even more so now that I am a mother, was how my mom had been able to keep a clear head, make a sharp left turn, and somehow keep us from being smashed, all while under attack by an unseen predator. Being a mom sometimes requires superhero skills, and she definitely employed those that day. In the years since then, I've used them myself to head off crises that my own motherhood experience has sent my way. But that night, my venture into motherhood was a lifetime away. As I slid my book into my school bag, I knew chance had saved the day, and that's all I needed to know.
Dina Nall left West Texas and its terrifying insects years ago. These days, she is about to finish her master's degree in professional and technical writing at University of Arkansas at Little Rock, where she teaches first-year writing. Next, one of motherhood's many challenges starts for DJ Duckworth with one simple question in It's My Job.
It was Thursday after school. We were piled up on the big green sofa eating some popcorn. "Mom, what does feck mean?" "What?" "You know, feck." "What do you mean, feck? I don't think that's a word, Corbin." "You know, like, feck you." Oh, no. How could my sweet little 7-year-old boy be asking me about the F word? Corbin, where'd you hear that word? On the bus ride to school. I stuck my head in the ground like an ostrich, slipped into denial mode, avoiding his question, and changed the subject. It worked for about 24 hours. The next time we were sitting at the dinner table finishing up some spaghetti. Mom, what does feck mean? My mouth went completely dry. I felt like I'd just morphed into a 1950s mother who didn't want to explain where babies came from. What happened to me? After all, I had prided myself on being that mother who always used honesty with her child. You see, when Corbin was 2 years old, he pointed to his penis and said, "Look at my wee-wee." "Nope, son, that's your penis." And then there was the time he got so furious, he said, "I'm gonna kick you right in the bra," as he pointed to my vagina. Corbin, this is my vagina. I wear a bra. I'm no stranger to someone dropping the F-bomb. I've spent a lot of time in newsrooms where swear words were used as nouns, verbs, adjectives, and adverbs. So I had been hyper aware of not swearing in front of Corbin. But of course, I began to question myself. Did he hear me say that? "Mom, tell me what feck means," Corbin said again as a glob of pasta sauce dribbled down his chin. In his defense, he attends a school with a large international population of students with a wide range of accents. And on top of it, he has a charming little southern accent too. The mix-up in the correct pronunciation of the F word came honestly, I believe. "Corbin, the word is beep and not feck. It's a really bad word that you cannot say at school ever. If your teachers hear you say that word, you will be sent to Mrs. Hirschman's office and you could be kicked out of school." I sat there glued to my seat, chewing my bottom lip, twisting a napkin and second-guessing myself and my explanation, and anxiously waited for my words to register with him. Okay, so in telling him part of the truth, I had to add some extra punch and toss in the threat of getting thrown out of school, which I don't think would really happen. But keep in mind, he is in the first grade and I can still put the fear of God in him. Sometimes. I stood up, grabbed my glass of wine, and walked away from the table. He followed me into the kitchen. He stood beside me at the sink, looked up at me with his innocent big brown eyes and said, "So what does beep mean?" At this point, he was using the correct pronunciation, which was more than a little unnerving. So I put on my big girl parenting pants, stopped pretending to be an ostrich, and answered his question. Kind of. "Corbin, it's a really bad word that grown-ups use when they're upset and can't find better words to explain their feelings. They say it, son, when they are really, really mad." "Okay, but what does it mean, Mom?" This kid is just like me. He knows when he's been given the runaround and his questions are not being answered. This persistent questioning skill will serve him well later in life, but at this particular moment, it was killing me. Am I really going to tell my 7-year-old what the F word means? He doesn't even know where babies come from. Am I going to take my Lego-loving, superhero wannabe down the road of unraveling the meaning behind the list of the 4-letter words that you shouldn't use but often do? Yeah, yep, I was. And I did. However, I never thought I'd have to start with the F word. Now explaining the S word, I could totally see myself having to say that, as that word often slips underneath my breath. I set my plate in the sink, my now empty wine glass on the counter, knelt down on one knee and looked him right in the eye. I took a deep breath. "Corbin, it means having sex." "Oh, so like when people love each other and they feel all tingly around each other?" "That's exactly right, honey, that's it." I am the biggest fraud in the history of time. We all know that is not exactly the definition of the F word, but that was about as much honesty as I could muster for one day. His face changed, he grew confident, and I could see from the look on his little face that he knew what it meant. I have no doubt he'll be explaining the proper use of the F word the next time it comes up on the bus ride to school. I just pray it's not within earshot of the bus monitor. Corbin turned on his heel and ran out of the kitchen. I stood up, poured myself another glass of wine. I realized that this was just the first of many conversations like this that I was going to have with Corbin in the days and years ahead. Sweaty palms and ripped up napkins aside, it is my job as his mother to teach him these things. If he can't count on me to tell it like it is, who's he going to be able to trust to tell him? After all, education is power, no matter what the subject. It's Friday night. We're sitting at the table, having breakfast for dinner. Mom? Yes, Corbin? What's a camel toe?
DJ Duckworth grew up in Carlisle, Arkansas. She has worked as television anchor, reporter, and producer, and currently lives in New York City. DJ is a contributing writer for New York Family Magazine. For more of her work, find more of her work at imdjduckworth.com. In our final story of the night, Heath Carpenter is unwillingly shown the light and concedes that his wife and soccer moms worldwide may have been onto something in Me, My Wife, and Oprah.
A CNN.com headline once read, "Admit it, Oprah changed your life." Like most men, when I read this, a patronizing grin spread briefly across my face. Over the years, my snarky attitude toward Oprah has produced several in-home tuffs between me and the missus. I'd come home after a long day at the office, and the kids would have commandeered the house. Peanut butter smears on the walls, Play-Doh mashed on the computer screen, the baby missing. It was all very Lord of the Flies. I needn't ask where their mother was. There she'd sit, 2 feet from the television, a heap of unfolded clothes in front of her, hypnotized, with the remote drooping out of her left hand, and a snot-laden tear catcher gripped tightly in her right. It was Oprah time, and Mommy was not to be messed with. In her defense, Hannah's never been much of a TV watcher, so to justify this guilty pleasure, she would fold clothes while watching. This is the one chore I am not allowed to mess with. I tried. Once. She begged, "Please don't take away my joy." I happily obliged. Admittedly, I watched Oprah a handful of times, mostly for her interviews of uber-famous yet enigmatic cultural figures, Michael Jackson at Neverland Ranch, or my favorite, her interview with a tearful Mike Tyson waxing philosophic about life and love. But it was one particular episode that I will never be allowed to forget. Hannah had always asked me to watch the show with her, and I'd always resisted, preferring instead to scoff from a distance. I would typically choose Oprah's hour as the time to do chores around the house that she'd normally have to beg me to do. It gave me the opportunity to announce magnanimously, "Don't worry about the dishes or the kids, I'll take care of it all. You just watch Oprah." However, after learning how sarcasm and passive aggressiveness are detrimental for communication and marriage, I agreed to watch an episode, chalking it up to loving my spouse more than myself and together time. Now, a bit of backstory is necessary. Before I had children, I was known by many as a heartless monster, with a wee black coal inside my chest and Kool-Aid, blue raspberry, running through my veins. However, apparently children change you, connecting you to others in ways that men are often unprepared, leaving us empathizing as never before. So post-child Heath was more in tune to his feelings, particularly when dealing with the misfortune of children. Enter Oprah episode. Just my luck. And the one day I agree to watch Oprah and she prays this pitiful father out to talk about his baby who has cancer. Immediately I look for a way to retreat. I thought, are you kidding me? The one flipping day I decide to watch this and it features a child with cancer? I glance over at Hannah, who grabs my hand. We exchange smiles. I suspected her immediately. She knew this was my kryptonite and purposely suckered me. Oprah has her routine down. She brings the family out and has them give the backstory. 2 minutes in, and this poor dad is bleary-eyed and inconsolable. Oprah splashes back and forth between the dad and images of his daughter at various stages of her cancer battle. Meanwhile, I'm squirming in my seat. I look over to see Hannah smearing mascara from her cheeks to her ears. I'm thinking, tough it out, Heath. You can do this, man. Get your act together. Oprah continues. By the end of the show, I had been dragged through an emotional upheaval. Every single human in Oprah's audience was belligerently weeping. The coup de grace happened in the end when the now cured girl was brought out to her loving father's embrace. It was then that Hannah asked me a question. I can't remember what she asked. It didn't matter. Heroically, I had been willfully fighting back weakness drops the entire episode. But when I opened my mouth to answer the question, all of the pent-up emotion escaped, and an unfortunate cry sound made manifest my cumulative unease. It sounded like an odd mixture of shouting and pain, blended unnaturally with a cat's meow. I had been caught. She quickly wheeled around and in an odd mixture of sympathy and mockery said, "See, it's good, isn't it?" On May 25th, 2012, after 25 seasons, Oprah went off the air. On that day, soccer moms around the country mourned in Old Testament ways. There was weeping, gnashing of teeth, wearing of black, as their fearless leader moseyed off into the sunset. Strike that. As their fearless leader moved to the O Network so she could attempt to expand her ever-growing empire. It wasn't that epic in our house. We had ditched satellite months before for Apple TV. Nevertheless, Oprah and I had our moment. And though I would just as soon forget it, Hannah won't let me. So I toast Oprah on her retirement and I concede defeat. Now, if I can just get Hannah to cry about something respectable, like the NCAA football national championship game post-game press conference, then we'll be even.
A father of four and husband, Heath Carpenter is currently an English teacher at Harding University and PhD student in heritage studies at Arkansas State. He comes from a modest line of Arkansas storytellers and embellishers. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are currently open for submissions from Southerners. For more information, go to talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in Person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
This next song is the single on this record up here. It's called Cruel. Sometimes I feel like you were so cruel, like you were so cruel. Like Judas Iscariot and Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible and Henry the Eighth, and there's you. So cruel, like you were so cruel. Like Judas Iscariot and Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible and Henry the Eighth, and there's you. We stood upon the stage and then we bowed together. Song beneath the summer sun. We walked and talked and laughed about our vision. Baby, all that you could ever do was run. Yeah, sometimes I feel so cruel, like Judas Iscariot and Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible and Henry the Eighth, and there's you. Want to take a little solo right there? You were so cruel, like you were so cruel.